Okay, good afternoon, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Welcome to Gail McConnell. I realize that this event is not as advertised because we were meant to have Mina Kandasamy with us. And it is, there's something tragic about the fact that the title of this event is Complicated Matters of State, and Mina cannot be with us due to a visa issue. Gail and I will be in conversation about our books, but I don't want Mina to miss out on the opportunity of her own work being promoted. So I will read from Mina's work to start us off. Then we'll have a reading from Gail, and then if we have time, I might read a bit from Amnion. We'll have a chat, and then we'll have questions. So welcome. Thank you so much. I'd like to thank our principal sponsor, Arts Council England. Thank you so much to Culture Ireland, who facilitated Gail's presence with us here today. Welcome to the online audience. Thank you so much for joining us. Gail McConnell is from Belfast. She is interested in the living and the dead, violence, creatureliness, queerness, and the possibilities and politics of language and form. Her debut poetry book, The Sun is Open, penned in the margins, won the John Pollard Foundation International Poetry Award, it's a bit of a mouthful, and the Christopher Ewart Biggs Memorial Prize. She has also published Northern Irish Poetry and Theology, and two poetry pamphlets. Would help if my phone screen didn't just turn off. For the Mother and 14. Gail has made two arts features based on her poetry for BBC Radio 4, For the Mother and The Open Box. Gail is reader in English at Queen's University Belfast. And Mina, in absentia, is a writer and translator from India. Her works include Exquisite Cadavers, Tomorrow Somebody Will Arrest You, When I Hit You, and Mrs. Militancy, among others. So she's the author of several poetry collections and some really exciting fiction, in my view. Exquisite Cadavers is out with Atlantic. It's my personal favorite of her books. And her poetry collection, Tomorrow Someone Will Arrest You, compiles her poetry from around 2007 to 2013. It's also the inaugural title of Atlantic's poetry list. Obviously, we have a vested interest in this, but every time there's a new poetry list announced, we get very excited about it, and we buy the books because we want them to keep publishing poetry. Books are on sale at the back of the room when the event is finished. So I'm going to read a little bit from Exquisite Cadavers for you, and then we'll hear from Gail. Also, as you can tell, my voice is quite strained and I'm a bit snuffly. This happens to me sometimes. So if there's nose blowing and stuff, I will try my best to lean away from my microphone, but I apologize. So Exquisite Cadavers is really exciting because it is, I don't know whether you'll be able to see, but you have, you know, basically normal text here, and then in the margins you have these columns of smaller text, which are sort of a running commentary from the narrator creator. And so it's really playing with this idea of often something that happens a lot to women or people of color or any person from some kind of marginalized group is that their authorial persona or the speaker of their poems gets conflated with them, themselves. And so Mina is really kind of staring that back down in this book, which is in part the result of the critical reception of her previous book, When I Hit You, which was sort of, it's fiction, but it was critiqued as if it were memoir. So I'm going to read the normal text and then the running commentary, and I'm going to do that for about a page and a half. Nothing hides mutual disdain as well as a marriage. Nothing hides a marriage in shambles as well as a spruced up orderly home. Stacked ceramic coffee mugs do not sneak up and tell others the story of unclasped hands. Clean linen sheets in their fail-safe lavender and citrus geometry are crisply deceptive. What can windowsills betray? Not the tight top knot of a sad woman who rests her elbows on them and counts the slow passing of the hours. Who can catalogue the things that are eating her? this disquieting silence from a dear one, the impending arrival of a child, the struggle to make up the monthly rent on time, memories of dead friends, a mother whose face she cannot bring herself to remember. On a sunny day in late March in Glasgow, we rush to the museum with our screaming toddler. Our train back to London is in less than an hour. We have decided to kill time. The all-glass lift shares our excitement. It takes us all the way up, all the way down, up, up again, tripping. On one of the floors, we get out. You go this way, I go that way, we catch up. I'm instructional. Museums work me up. A perky, voracious appetite. In this country, they are free. Visitors free to devour ideas. I get engrossed in a short film being played on loop. I like the mood it evokes. Dark, in a darkened room. I settle on this, decide to steal its location. On the journey home, he looks after our son. I look up the movie. Who can prize and persuade walls to reveal what they have witnessed? Holding no permanent memories, they are ill-equipped to paint out the pictures of parting shadows. Ashtrays are tight-lipped traitors. They remain smug, clumsily carrying the charred remains of late afternoons with the indifference of embedded journalists. The other character will be suitably English. That is all I know at this point. On the way home, I make my grand announcement. My new novel will be partly set in London. Is it about us? No. Is it based on us? No. Maybe. Where in London? Where we live? Where we lived before? Generic London. Gentrified. Is there something about the first time we invented the first mojito for Walthamstow? No. Is it political? No, love. It is very domestic. Thank you.
Hello. I'll never not feel awesome with a Britney mic. It's slightly strange, but great. It's really lovely to be here. Thanks for coming out on a Sunday afternoon, or tuning in on a Sunday afternoon if you're at home. Thank you, Stephanie, for the invitation. It's my first Ledbury. Happy to be here. So I'm going to start my timer so that we're not all here until Christmas. I'm going to read from The Sun is Open, and this is a book that swirls around an autobiographical event, and that event is my father's murder. He was a prison governor in the Mays prison, and when I was 3.5, he was shot and killed outside our home in Belfast. My mother and I were standing in the front driveway, waving him off to work. He was checking underneath his car for bombs, as he did every morning. And two gunmen came across the street. They'd been holding up our elderly neighbours at gunpoint all night. And they came into the drive and shot him dead and tried to shoot my mother, who survived. So on the 6th of March, 1984, my life was shaped by this event and by all the history that kind of comes flooding in with that, the conflict that we call the Troubles. But also a much bigger and broader history, I suppose, about colonialism and class and politics and all kinds of things. So as an adult, I inherited a box that I call the Dad Box, which is really a personal archive of stuff about his murder and about his life, but mostly about his murder. And it was really stacks and stacks of paper that were given to me by my grandmother and my mother and my aunts. And they contain things like cutouts from the newspapers about his murder, Hansard parliamentary records where his murder was debated and discussed. I had his student diaries from his time at Queen's. He was an undergraduate student of history and politics in the 60s, and I had his diaries. And so the poems in this book, they quote from those sources, but they also sort of range outside the Dad Box. I was very aware that every archive has its politics, and there were things that were not in that box that would tell a different story about his murder. Like one of those things, for example, was the IRA statement about his murder. So I went to that source. And I went to Shakespeare, and I went to Super Ted and Banana Man and Keats and all sorts of things, because I wanted to try to make an expansive book. I'd written about my father's murder before in a long poem called Typeface, and that exists in quite an adult and quite angry and slightly ironic, very ironic actually, mode of writing. And I wanted to make a book that had my childhood experience in it, that was also about 1980s Belfast, and that could move between a kind of child and adult self. So that's what I've tried to do, I think, with this work. And it tries to think about the sort of complicated politics of my home place and my father's work in the prison service. You know, he was seen by some as not a person, but a screw, a representative of British state power, and all the kind of oppressive machinery of surveillance and domination that comes with that. You know, the IRA saw him as a legitimate target. So that was one of the stories about my father. And my other one, you know, another one was that, you know, he was a kind of martyr. And another was that he was my dad. And I suppose I had this archive of stuff that was all about his life and death, but I just had no sense of who he was. And maybe the poems gave me a way to try to imagine him and imagine our relationship. So I think there's probably not much else you need to know, except to say that there's one poem which begins with the phrase, "He left," and I'm going to raise my voice when I read that poem for a little minute. So thank you so much for your attention, and I'm just going to read now from this book. It opens with a note that's very kind of similar to some of the things I would have found in the newspaper cutouts. So I'm going to begin with that and then read the poems. On the morning of March 6th, 1984, Mr. William McConnell, Assistant Governor of the Mays Prison, was outside his home, checking underneath his car for explosive devices, when he was shot dead in front of his wife and 3-year-old daughter. Begin with victim on his back is how this could begin. Place your mouth over his mouth. Pinch his nostrils shut. Easier to take what I have found and break it up. Breathe steadily till victim's chest begins to rise. Pause every minute to glue it back the wrong way. Take a deep breath yourself. If there is no air exchange, do not touch him. You come into this world head first. Come in on your rump, they call it breech. You may be lifted out. I'm making soft returns. For this you need 2 keys, shift and enter to go down. The line carries on, the carriage moving back. Our house was on a street that slanted at the bottom, a carriageway you didn't cross, 4 lanes, all going 50, to a roundabout nearby. The dog next door was Honey, a lab as old as me, who loved to lie on the just-cut lawn and sniff, her tail going in the afternoon sun. There was a time when I was Brian, like our neighbour 6 doors down. I had a skateboard with a monkey skull on the underside. My cards read, "Happy birthday, Brian," whose dad, we knew not to say, was in the police. That day, he must have been dead scared, hearing the shots. They're coming now, for him, for me. He might have thought. He had a test in school that day. He knew if X, then Y, but couldn't make the pencil cross the page. It lay along his pointer. Then he folded back three fingers, raised his thumb to make a gun shape. Dream about a man in a car engine, his head sticking out, the car ramming into doors, him going into them head first. When he stands up, there's no top on his head. You can see inside coils of uncooked sausages in there. He pirouettes, falls to the ground, raw meat where the mind should be, or what it is, the plump white skin, so pale. You assemble it yourself. It came flat pack, a square with folded sides. You put them all in place and twist in shallow screws. You punch the pins through holes, fold back the legs, put in what you have. Mostly piles of cutouts from the papers, 8 inches thick. Church bulletins, school magazines, Hansard, Bibles, a student's union diary from his time at Queen's, things he wrote, reports. Hey presto, got a dad box. Wrote that on the side. Not sure why. When we have guests, I turn it to the wall. When I want to see inside, I make piles on the spare room bed and on the floor. Then forget what it was I was looking for. The patient is pale, his skin cold and clammy. Quick and irregular shock can occur. Send for a doctor, slow pulse and pallor. Give him a sweet drink, lay his arms down. Kneel at his head, place the palms down. Your mouth over his, the first movement starts. Breathing out, breathing in. When breathing has stopped, allow lungs to empty. Take your lips from his face. The patient should lie in a cool, shady place, his head raised so blood can drain from his brain. Family see jail chief shot dead. PM backs her Ulster team. Tell us the truth, urges jail widow. The haunting of the NIO. Faith alive in Belfast. Crosswords on the back. Moor days evade iron prism. We burned the boats, we burned the sweets, we burned the packages they came in, burned the leaves along the path, we burned the bits of paper dropped on pavement slabs, we burned the sign that said wet paint, burned the grass and then the edges of our shoes, we burned our laces at the ends, the plastic melting as they frayed, we burned a track left on a bench, we burned the matches in the box, then burned the box the matches came in. Around noon, the girl took her auntie by the hand to the rows of rose bushes where her father wasn't. Around noon, the men sent out for fish and chips, and as they sat eating, they watched the lunchtime news to find out if they had killed their target. How did we spin the thread that tethered each to each? Me, you, you, me. How did we exist before these letters, all these sounds? I know sound, we had enough to sound out the line between us. I had a sound for you. By it, I called you Daddy. You had one for me, the name you gave me, between one and two syllables. Gail, you called me, your twice-voiced daughter. He left. The vertical went from to. A changing shape, a fall, a turn, 90 degrees. I look up, vertical. It turns to vertex, the apex, the crown of the head, a whirlpool swirling into a vert, turning his head, my mother shouting, Bill! Turning it towards what was coming. Just to say. A trio of cards saying nothing to say. Just this. Just grief. Just not what is just. For so long, it was hard to mourn, thinking from that side of things, bad bastard, screw in the mechanism, the panopticon, the architecture of brutality, knowing the theory, the cruel, ingenious cage, thinking, shit, that's him, on the wrong side of the gaze. Baked potato alphabet, laid out on the sheet. She lifted up and tilted. All the letters fell onto my plate beside the beans. I spelled the words I knew and some I didn't yet. The T upended and a bit lopped off, you have an L. I make my name, then take it by the lip, swivel it in place to show her, there I am, in the news, on, in the corner. Captions scroll from right to left. We watch to see what's breaking. My father rejoices. That's what it means. My name, I mean. But did he? What, if anything, was the source of his joy? Was there joy between us before he left? Or after he walked through the hall, the squeaky door saddle, across the tiles, walking outside into the morning, into those bullets sailing through the blue air, into perforation, into a heap, into gravel, an almost human shape, into death, into silence, or whatever comes after. Look to the mountains. Help will come. Let your awake guard you. The sun will not hurt. Day, moon, night, come and go.
Thank you so much, Gail. I remember the first time I ever saw you read was actually also an opportunity where we had to read together at the launch of an issue of Poetry Review, which was online. Mm-hmm. And if you've ever seen Gail read on Zoom, it's quite the experience because she stares straight down the camera, you're probably not the only one, but I remember being so, so struck by that.
You going to read?
Oh, yeah. I did say I would do that, didn't
you
I?
You did.
Okay, I'm going to stay seated for my reading. I am going to read a little bit from Amnion. Let's see, what could I read that would chime with this? Okay, so my father is Filipino, and my great-grandmother was one of three sisters. She was the Caridad charity. Her sisters were called Fe and Esperanza, so faith and hope. and one of the, let's say, elided events of the Second World War in the Asian theater of war, the Pacific theater of war, is the massacre of Manila, which is when the Japanese were withdrawing, the Japanese army were withdrawing through Manila, and the Americans and the Americans were fighting them off, but it was very, very intense fighting, and so they went street by street through Manila. And as the Japanese withdrew, or were pushed back, for every Japanese soldier who was killed, the remaining Japanese soldiers would go into every house and round up two men for every Japanese fatality. And so a lot of the men on that side of my family died in the massacre of Manila. And then the remains were taken away to an undisclosed location, and they've actually never been found. So not only were, you know, were you, did you have these sort of horrible reprisals, and after all, they were civilians that they were rounding up, but there was no, as I say, the remains are missing. They were stolen. And so this is about the massacre of Manila. The range of casualties is very broad because no one really knows. You know, numbers range from the sort of low thousands to, you know, over 10,000 or more, I think. If we are to go back again, there were three sisters, great-great-aunts, by names of Fe, Esperanza, and Caridad. In the under-discussed massacre of Manila in February 1945, Fe was widowed in the two-for-one, street-by-street Japanese retreat. At the creak of bootstep on the stair, she bassinet-snatched her sleeping baby and hid in a cupboard. Sure enough, in comes a soldier, and from the cupboard crack Fe can see, he bassinet bayonets immediately. Esperanza became a vegan and a nun. Now she mothers superior and Carmelite near Loag. Shall I entertain you with the fetishism of a foreign name? My father, when a little boy, was taken to the visiting room, which is latticed split, and asked, "Are you a bird? Because you are in a cage." Caridad was 5 years wed and childless, an enigma to all invested. She sustained dum-dum fire in the same said Japanese retreat, caught in crossfire on the walk home from consoling the women of her family. So I should have added, actually, at the beginning, a dum-dum bullet is a special kind of semi-heavy artillery. The head of it, so it's a bullet which has a cavity in the head of the bullet, which is designed to explode on impact, so it's designed to make a much bigger wound than a normal bullet would, and obviously, you know, creates really horrible injuries. And she was shot in her lower back. Brother, father, men all rounded up. A soldier, sniper slain, and a radius drawn where he fell, from which to take all the men to be found. Caridad's husband gesturing from a first floor window for her to stop, but she misread him, and he jumped as she fell in the street, a bullet expanding in her back. Luckily, her neighbor was an obstetrician and stitched her up face down between the stirrups, having only whiskey to clean what would become a fist-fit hollow in her back. He had time to see her uterus was retrograde, so he rectified. And Lola, which is the Filipino for grandmother, was born in March of 1946. Uh, Now I'm going to read you a short passage about my other grandmother, my maternal grandmother. I don't think you need any context for this. She went to Oxford in 1945. Her village pooled cloth rations so she could have a suit. She lived off crumpets with no butter. She lost her riding accent to the rounded vowels of the South. In that gold and spired city, she dreamed that all the cyclists in their gowns turned crows and lifted off the cobbled road, that she woke in the closed part of an upper E for an exam. She refers offhand to boyfriends in this period and smoking cigarettes and going to visit one, a stained glass craftsman. She loved to watch him work in the great smog. At 26, her parents died within 6 weeks of one another, a heart attack, a broken heart. She became a Catholic and went to Rome to study theology. She lived in a new build on a hill behind the Vatican. Perhaps she tried to become a nun. She wrote a book on Julian of Norwich and how God is actually the mother. She wanted a retranslation of the Gospel of Matthew, because the word used of Jesus' mother in the old Hebrew Bible is Alma, meaning only young woman, and the Greek Septuagint describes her as Parthenos, young holy woman, with the implication of virgin. She wanted to sweep aside millennia worth of staggered mistranslations. She was a woman who believed that a great deal of harm had been done by paratexts. One of this story's beginnings takes place in my grandmother's 40-year-old body, which was rare at the time. Thank you. Gail, you seem to have notes. What are they for?
Well, they're about your work.
Well, I think the reading that I did at the beginning of this event from Mina's book, I mean, I knew that basically whatever I chose from her book would be exciting, but I wasn't expecting to read kind of a perfect passage for to be in dialogue with our books as well. So that mention of is it political? No, it's very domestic, or it will be very domestic. Mm. And I think that's something that your book does so remarkably well, is really probing that idea of the domestic versus the political, and that being a false binary. Is that something that you want to speak to?
It's funny, I teach a big module in Irish poetry where we start with Kieran Carson and sort of go back to W.B. Yeats and read through An Amazing Century of Writing. But this year I taught a class that was kind of on that issue, actually, about the domestic, and the domestic being always already political, and that, exactly that kind of false binary. And I suppose, you know, that emerges for me from just this very early and fairly traumatic experience of politics coming home. Like, there's politics in the driveway, like, there's the conflict, and kind of grief and mourning and atrocities that happen kind of at home. And, you know, ours was one of thousands that happened at home. So, and even just, I think, that idea of, like, the news on in the corner, you know, the way in which, that the language of political discourse and media and all kinds of things is at home. And someone whose work, I suppose, has been very important to me in thinking about the personal as political and the political as personal and the domestic and the public being kind of always kind of entwined, is Denise Riley, and especially her work on language. And we know what she says is that we kind of bubble away with the language of everything, of like pop songs and like bad like TV jingles and advertising, and like there's an idea that we have that we think in a kind of private language that's sort of somehow untouched by the world, but actually that's a lie, that the language that we think with, our most intimate language of thought, is always already written over by the whole history of the English language, with all of its like Greek and Old Norse and Latin etymologies and roots and everything. So that means that language is always at home and out of the home at once. It's always private and public at once. And so if you're working in language, you're kind of, all of those things are like richly enfolded and entwined and tangled up together, I suppose. And that has been a very, kind of freeing idea. But I think there have been lots of, I suppose, feminists in particular whose work in that 70s period and afterwards have really shown that like domestic happenings, domestic labour, but also just the domestic is always a site of politics. Yeah, absolutely. I guess I could ask the same thing back to you, because your work is interested in different spaces, like cathedral spaces and school spaces, the space of boarding house and the space of home, and the kind of formations that go on in those spaces. And you know, your book at once charts a kind of very personal story. There's like a coming of age that happens of being a teenager in boarding school, and also the ways in which all of these kind of myths of England and myths of different colonial myths kind of come rushing into you kind of in that space as well. And so I love in your work that the personal and political are all kind of folded together. I don't know if you want to speak to that back, but
well, thank you. Yeah, I mean, I suppose I was very preoccupied by structures, by which I mean physical buildings, and the ideas that they are built in service to. So whether that's a church or an educational institution or the Houses of Parliament, and I was very interested in architectural motifs. And how the I was very, very lucky to do history of art A level, and if you do history of art, you know, you look at all the art forms, including architecture, and you're taught how to read buildings. And I actually find that was one of the things I studied at school, which has like the most day-to-day application, in that if you start paying attention to buildings and the motifs that they're using. I mean, it's exactly the same as, you know, when politicians speak in sort of dog whistle racist terms, or when you see, you know, certain words that are tainted by a certain usage or a certain context being used. So, for instance, in the building we're in now, you know, this is a hall, but it's also very reminiscent of a church. You know, it is a big arched structure. I mean, it's not really arched, but... you know, it's got that very, very basic longitudinal structure. And then you have the kind of platform at the back, platform at the front, you know, and we know the drill when we come into a structure like this. You know, you and I are even sitting up on a little dais at the front, and you're listening to what we have to say. and that setup alone primes you to have a certain experience. But then also structures of the mind and structures of thought. So I like to use the term structures of faith, because that kind of encompasses, you know, a church structure or anything that replicates a church structure. You know, like the Palace of Westminster looks a lot like a cathedral. And what is that telling us? You know, what... if a cathedral is enshrining an idea, and then you have other buildings borrowing the motifs of cathedrals, what are they enshrining? And structures of faith, you know, that's ideas. So that could be the nuclear family, or the idea that Britain has been an exclusively benevolent force in international affairs throughout its history, or, you know, the idea of heterosexuality, or... you know, any number of things is a structure of faith. And when we step outside those structures into the open air, you know, they can still be there. That's fine. I wouldn't say it's fine. But, you know, they are still there in our midst, and figuring out how we negotiate those structures afresh is the work incumbent upon us all, you know. As artists, as writers, as people, as thinkers. But I suppose with your book, I mean, it frequently gets described as being able to hold so much, because there is this traumatic event of your early childhood in this, you know, context, a long imperial history, and then, as you say, the conflict that we call the Troubles, and you know, depending on which historical scale you want to take, that sort of is enfolded into bigger and bigger histories. Mm. But it tells so many stories, and as you say, from the many different perspectives of all the many documents inside the dad box. We were talking earlier about John Berger, who, as I've said here before, is a favourite of mine.
She actually said, one of my top 10 babes, is what she said.
Yeah.
Which I would agree with.
John Berger and his famous phrase in his 1972 novel G, never again will a single story be told as if it is the only one, which has had a rather remarkable afterlife. It's a sentence which has been used as the epigraph of several novels. Arundhati Roy's The God of Small Things, which won the Booker Prize in 1998. Michael Ondaatje's In the Skin of a Lion. And that phrase, in several different permutations, also appears in lots of different texts, so like novels by Kamla Shamsie, other novels of Michael Ondaatje's. So it sort of has spawned this lineage of like Marxist writers. And I was really very much recognized that in your work. And I mean, was that something you were conscious of? And is it, to you, is it tied to that ideology?
Hmm. It's interesting. So I suppose one of the reactions I have just to a word in that sentence now is a reaction to the word story. Because I suppose part of me is a little reticent about narrative. And the reason for that is I grew up in a very religious home, and my parents had very strong Christian faith. And when my father was murdered, my mother really felt like she was kind of visited by God, I suppose, and given the strength and love to be able to survive this event, but also to forgive my father's murderers. And she had very strong evangelical faith, and a lot of my childhood was spent listening to what Protestants call my mum's testimony, which is a story, essentially, that's about how she came to faith and how God has turned her life around, essentially. So it's very much a kind of redemptive story that has an arc, like a clear sort of happy ending. Even though, like, in the midst of all that, and central to this story, is my father's murder. And what I realized growing up is that I had heard that story over and over again, but at no point in my childhood, and particularly in my church experience, had I been given the opportunity to grieve, to be angry, to sit with this event for what it was, and not to fast forward to the part where we had love and forgiveness and happy ever after. And so that story was untrue. Like, it was not true for me. And yet it was kind of the only story that I felt like, I mean, it was the single story, I suppose, that my mother was living by, but I didn't feel like I could live by, but I wasn't being given, I guess, any others. So I suppose in that sense, this book is trying to tell multiple, maybe stories, but maybe also just, you know, the poems are written in these little boxes of text. They're kind of compressed and constrained on the page. It's a kind of book-length poem in a way, so I think of it as a whole. Not even necessarily a story, because it has no ending, really, because grief has no ending, and grief is kind of lifelong work, I think. But certainly it's a whole, but it's also a series of individual poems. So, yeah, it's definitely, there was a desire to kind of tell a complicated version of my father's murder, where I could think about him as my daddy, I could think about him as a bad bastard, I could think about him as someone I didn't know at all, I could think about myself as kind of, you know, like cashing in on his murder by writing this book. So there's a moment in the book where I kind of say, you know, I'm playing the murder card, you know, I'm trying to get my way, I'm just using this event, I'm kind of making aesthetic capital of it. So I wanted to get all those complications into the book because, you know, I wanted the book to be as complicated as I am and as grief is and as life is. So in that sense, yeah, absolutely. Like, never again will there be a single story told about this murder. But even, I think even I always have a sense of reticence about the idea of story as something that has an ending. Actually, I think that's what it is more than, yeah, anything else.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, there are two things that I think of in response to that. One is Rebecca Solnit gave this commencement address at UC Berkeley School of Journalism, which is in one of her recent essay collections. But the idea behind the commencement address was break the story, which is, after all, what we, you know, journalists break the story when news is breaking. And, you know, you mentioned the kind of ticker tape of news running at the bottom of the screen and what is breaking. And, you know, Rebecca Solnit basically says that the work of the journalist is to crack our pre-existing narratives because they imprison us in our prejudices, and to be constantly expanding our understanding of our society and how we live with one another, and also to understand how the stories are no longer serving us well and we need new ones. And so, you know, basically journalism, but also writing and art and, you know, cultural endeavor of any kind, is engaged in this liberation work of breaking the story, and dismantling it, I guess, or letting it breathe a bit, throwing you know, blowing the bloody doors off. And then the second thing that I think of is the queer theorist Lee Edelman and the idea of no future. And so Edelman's idea is basically springs from his rage at the, you know, it comes from the height of the AIDS crisis, when the sort of narratological thrust of, you know, a generative society that says we do such and such for our children. That was really the phrase that irked him the most. And this, you know, this sort of like caricature, you know, Les Mis kind of waif who is proffered as this, I don't know, pathos-generating cue into which all our political endeavors are meant to be channeled. And Edelman's question is basically, you know, we deserve all those things too. What about us? It's not selfish to say that we deserve all the things we're supposedly preparing for our children in the present. And this idea of no future is basically, you know, if we did away with this idea of continuance for continuance's sake, we might actually be able to bring a better world into being in the here and now. I see both of those ideas flitting around the edges of your book in certain ways.
I mean, Edelman wouldn't like me too much because I'm a queer person who's sold out and become a parent who is now like invested in my five-year-old's future and doing that kind of queer family making. But thinking about that question, like, I'm struck in your work, if I consult my notes, Stephanie, since I should know that you've drawn attention to them, something that I like in your work, because I, you know, and it resonates with something that I think I'm doing in The Sun is Open, is the way that you foreground the act of the work. And by the work, I mean not just the writing, but the work that you're talking about, which is the recovery of stories that, you know, work against the grain of colonialism and imperialism and nationalisms of various kinds, and kind of an invitation for the reader actually as well to do that work. So, like, I think of, I am writing now from the inky heart of empire. I have shuffled all the shards of what came to me broken. I am eluding your impulse. I am trying my best. And like, there are these really amazing moments of showing the endeavor of writing, but also a kind of vulnerability of, you know, I'm trying. And there's a kind of wonkiness in that also that I kind of appreciate. And I think both of our books try to show, you know, that the process of the making the thing itself, but it's also about the work that is ongoing, which is the internal, like, psychological work and grief work and other things, but also I think is at its best an invitation to other people to kind of join in on some of that work. How do you feel about those moments in the book of I am writing?
Yeah, I like your word wonkiness. It's funny because Will Harris was he was kind enough to give the book a blurb where he said amnion squirms. Mm. And I thought, like, yeah, my book is pretty wriggly. And I like that he's identified that. And so now I can add wonky to the list, which I like a lot. No, I think it's really important to be honest about process because, you know, you're writing in dialogue with your peers and with your predecessors, in every art form. And you always want your work to be gesturing outside of itself all my favorite work does that, because, you know, it's a form of citation, and citation is a form of care and regard for, you know, no piece of art appears in a vacuum, and I think it's a very, like, isolationist and, dare I say, masculine conception of genius, which sort of posits that to our detriment, to the detriment of all of us. It's funny that you read that bit about the inky heart of empire, because that's London. But I did an event at Edinburgh Book Fest last year where I said, and you might be able to call this the neatly kept ledger of empire. And yeah, that went over like a lead balloon. And I think that, again, to come back to that idea of, like, what came to you broken, for me, the idea of the museum, which is also a cathedral of a kind, was quite useful for that, because in writing about family history and writing about compiling the fragments, arranging the fragments of family history, and using, so there's a lot of, you know, allusion to museums in my book, that, for me, captured the ambiguity of, yes, you've dug the fragments out of the ground, and you've pieced them together, and that is a loving and reparative act. But then you've also taken them, you've not let the sleeping dogs lie, you know, you've taken them out of the place where they were kind of minding their own business, and you've pillaged them, you know, and you've put them on display. The double-edged nature of that, I thought was... it captured my own misgivings, I would say.
Mm. Yeah, I'm struck that actually by foregrounding the I doing the work, like I am writing this, that is actually the route to be collaborative and to acknowledge your sources and to acknowledge the collaborative venture. Like, that makes sense to me, because I was working with this stack of paper that I had, and, you know, the first poem that I read, begin with victim on his back. I mean, those are the first aid instructions from my father's diary. You know, I was just inserting my voice here and there in this material that I had already. So it's interesting that those moments of wonkiness, in a way, where you show the eye doing its work, is actually not to kind of shine all the light on the eye, but to say that this is a work that is in a strange way collaborative, like even collaborative with the dead and, you know, all that kind of stuff. Yeah.
Yeah. We probably should go to questions. Does anyone have any? Any from the online audience, perhaps? Yes, lady at the back. Yeah.
Has been what the context in which you've, the context of the world in which you've been living. And we've also talked about moments where you may have had discovery from the past. Mm. For instance, the daddy box at 18. I'm not sure what the equivalent would be. And I wonder just what sort of effect that's had on your writing, that you have a sense of who you are to a period, and then there's an influx of material that changes that.
Yeah, goodness, that's a great question. It's a life's work, isn't it, trying to figure out kind of who you are and what you are. I mean, I mentioned earlier, like, I'm a queer person and I'm a parent, and actually it was trying to think about queer family making that helped me connect with, like, child me. So The Sun Is Open came out when our son was 3.5, so he was the age I was when my father was killed, and I actually was writing it at the time, and my partner and I were trying to work out how will we start a family, and she was beginning to undergo IVF, and I was having to try to imagine myself into the role of parent. And in doing that, I was able to then sort of imagine my father and my relationship with him, but then I was also imagining myself as a child. And then when Finn, our son, came along, what was really interesting about that was that for a long time, it was impossible for me to believe that I had known my father at all, because I couldn't remember him. But when we had our son, and he was 3.5, I was like, well, I have lived 600 lifetimes with you. Like, I know you so well, and you know me so well. And suddenly, like, something clicked into place about, I must have had this with my father, though I do not remember it at all, but it must be in my body somewhere, and it's going to be in these poems now, and it's going to be something that I imagine. So I don't know if that answered your question at all, except to say that it is constantly changing, and it changes in all these multiple ways, like where I'm thinking about myself as the child I was, as the child I have, as the parents I had, the parent I am. And I like thinking in that sort of transgenerational mixed up way a lot. And so it's sort of an endlessly unfolding process of discovery and imagination, actually, because more powerful than what was in the box was the relationship I was able to imagine with my father. The materials themselves were pretty dry, you know, and mostly it was about him being dead forever. But having a child, I was suddenly able to think, imagine what, yeah, me and my dad, what that would have been.
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, when I was writing Emily, and it was very important to me not to sit all my family members down and say, okay, now you're going to tell me the whole story. You know, I tried to compile what they had willingly, you know, unknowingly said in my presence, and little did they know I was paying a lot of attention. And so, because I didn't want to nail it all down, you know, and be like, okay, now it's the butterfly that I've crucified and put in the box and put on the wall, you know. And so it's been really interesting after Amnion's, after it was acquired. So I sent the manuscript to my family members before I sent it to my agent to say, do I have your blessing to continue with trying to let this see the light of day? And I was very, very lucky that they all said yes. And so ever since that point, it's been really funny to see how, like, all this other family history has come out of the woodwork that I didn't know about. And I thought, wow, would have been really great to put that in the book. But, you know, to me, it's really exciting because it shows that it's still generative and alive and in flux. And also that this it doesn't belong to me, you know, like, I just have my arrangement. And then that's that, you know? Lady at the front.
Hi, Gail. I appreciate your work. I think it's beautiful, and I'm speaking from a position of empathy. I have a daddy box. My father was murdered by an ex-psychiatric patient. I'm 7 years liberated from an atrocity. 17 years of chemical slavery under psychiatric care after my graduation at Dartington Hall. I was walking down the street in Totnes, a little teary, and a muggle told me to go to a clinic, and I did because I couldn't think straight through the tears, and a shrink came out of the woodwork, coshed me on the head, the chemical cosh, and I was put away for 17 years. But I was liberated by my father's murder. Is John Minton the second. John Minton the first was also chemically removed. He was assistant managing director of Mölnlycke, Swedish company. And on top of his box, I have a Mölnlycke box. I found an old box when I was going through my mother, who also died suddenly. I was going through her stuff. And on top of his box, I have the hat of a genius, a Welsh writer, poet, novelist, who suicided 2 years ago. I have 20 deaths in my piece. And it's called The Martyrology. So I feel a kindred hearing you speak, and I deeply value and appreciate your work.
That's very kind.
Being here right now with you.
That's very kind, and I'm very sorry for your losses. I think so many of us have a dad box of a sort, you know, whether we've experienced a kind of traumatic loss or a one that seems more simple. I think so many of us carry the mementos of the dead, and we all in our ways like work through archives. So I'm very conscious that my story is one of very many probably in this room that a lot of people could tell. So thank you for sharing some of yours, and I'm sorry.
Yeah, I mean, I don't mean this to sound dismissive or crass in the wake of that, but I think one thing people say to me after events is they come up and they say, you have such an interesting family history, and, you know, mine's really boring. And I always say, there's no such thing as a boring family history. We all have a dad box or a whatever box, and, you know, somewhere along the line, there will be something really, something that will reframe your way of thinking about yourself and your own history. And, you know, just because, you know, your family history takes place in a certain place or my family history takes place in more than one place doesn't make it any more interesting than any of yours. So, yeah, I would encourage you to engage with the daddy boxes. Any other questions? Yes.
This is a question for Gail. Is how does your other family, how do other family members feel about your poetry? How does your mother feel about what you've written, or
other family members? I'm not sure. Is the truth? I'm not sure. She's given me a lot of freedom to just. Or maybe that's the wrong way to put it. Maybe I've just taken a lot of freedom. Like, unlike Stephanie, I didn't ask my family for a kind of permission. I didn't show them the work before it was published. So I took a great risk in publishing this work. I'm honestly not. But I'm not sure if my mother has read it. I don't know. You know, we have a relationship where I think we sort of talk around a lot of things, and. My stepfather, actually, my mother married again when I was a teenager, and he has been much more direct about his appreciation for the book, and he's said enough for me to know that he's read it. But my mom, I don't know. And, you know, I think in some ways we're on two different tracks with it. You know, she has her story, the one that I kind of shared earlier, and that she shares it a lot, and she shares it publicly, and I have now found my way to tell what feels true about my experience of this, and they kind of just coexist, and we have a relationship, so we don't really speak about it, and we don't speak a lot about my father really either, but sometimes, occasionally. So I'm not sure. I mean, somebody might see that as kind of ruthless or risky or something. I think that's always, there is always a risk that comes with art, but I will say that a lot of this came about after years and years of doing a lot of therapy, like doing a lot of talking therapy and doing a lot of work with myself and with this material. And I think, you know, whatever about how my family were going to feel, you can never really, who knows how they're going to react, but it was really important for me to do that work. And that was the thing that prepared me to write this book and to be able to stand now and breathe these poems into the room with you. Because that's the bit I can do something about. My family, you know, I don't know, and their responses might change over time, but that's the thing that I could take into my control, and that was a bit that felt really important. Yeah, but thanks for the question.
Yeah, well, and also, like, I think these things are always very difficult with parents and children and, you know, other family members having different versions, but actually, you know, if you and your mother have reached a point where she has her way and you have yours, I mean, I'm not a parent, but I would say that that's quite a profound act of parenting to say, you know, you do you.
Yeah, I mean, it's very freeing that she, in some ways, that we don't have those conversations, actually. Yeah, and that she's not sort of in on the detail of it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, one more question.
Yeah, thank you both really very much. I kind of just wanted to sort of follow that and say, that is an act of generosity, but there is also another side to that. There's something about growing up, being provided with a narrative that doesn't give you any oxygen to breathe, any space, as you've talked about, to find your own narrative to develop and to even process your own response. And so then later in life, working through stuff to the point where you need to tell your story, or one needs to tell one story, is kind of, well, I'm just taking the space. you know, I didn't ever have the space, and it kind of needs to happen. There are lots of ways of doing that. Sometimes we do that. We have conversations with the people who provided their narrative to exclusion of our own, and sometimes we don't. I'm thinking about Bechdel. Her name's just gone.
Alison
Bechdel. Yeah. And she had a lot of dialogue with her mum about telling those stories. Mm. Quite incredible, really, how much she discussed that. Yeah. Maybe the word enmeshed comes to mind quite often when I'm reading through that. And then others of us have no conversations at all. Mm. So, you know, it's a very complex area that can be worked through in art. So I'm going to come now to the thing I've been thinking about all the way along before you got to that, to say, think about Rebecca Solnit, and that's such a great thing that you introduced there, how she talks about breaking the story is also breaking open the story, which is, of course, what you have both done in different ways in your work. And I wonder whether that's something that those of us who have, whether because of people who are artists or people who, through occupying, having an identity which places them in a particular relationship to social norms and so on, actually we can take that as a form of privilege because it gives us, in a sense, more permission to break open those stories. And I'm thinking about the kind of the shock of the act of breaking, of smashing open and saying, whatever with your stories, your stories have never fit me. You've never actually wanted my story. I can break the story. That's actually my skill. This is my gift to all of you who are going to just not open stories, who are going to keep the boxes closed, who are, you know, whatever the metaphors, whatever they're doing, we occupy certain, you know, we're different in some way, whether because we overthink, whether because we creatively think, whether because we're queer, disabled, whatever it is, that we occupy a space, you know, some other place. So I was wondering whether, for you as a queer writer, actually that was part of the power, that's part of what gave you the power to do this, breaking and breaking open.
It's funny because, like the word story, I think I have a little bit of a reaction to that idea of breaking the story because, you know, that line, we watched to see what's breaking, like what was breaking, like we were, like my father's murder was literally breaking news. It was a thing that was going along the bottom of the screen, and I didn't want to be the subject of breaking news. Like that didn't feel, again, it was just like there's this one story. And when I was writing this, you know, we often talk about line breaks in poetry or line endings. What distinguishes poetry from prose at its simplest? Line breaks, like there is lineation, you hit return at a certain point. And when I was trying to write this, I found it impossible to break the line. I didn't know when to hit return. It was like, it was so hard to make that decision, and it really felt like so much is breaking, like emotionally, psychologically. This whole story is about death and brokenness, and that I didn't want to have to make that decision about hitting return. So I set up this little template for myself in Word where I could just write into a box and never have to break the line, and it would do it for me. There would be this soft return where the line would go back. That's the thing, the carriage moving back. And I did that because it was like, again, this almost, you know, breaking comes with a sense of like violence again. And sometimes I didn't want to do anything like rupture. I just wanted to be quiet and still and sit with grief and not the kind of, here's the story at all, but just the like, what is the really small thing now that feels like, now I know the texture of loss or the texture of grief, and how can I write into that, but not the thing that's going to make the headlines, because I had so many headlines, but just the thing that would never make the headlines. And at the same time, of course, what I'm doing is opening things up, and of course there is a kind of breaking open that's in that, but I just notice myself like recoil a little from that idea of rupture, I suppose, as well. Yeah, I don't know if you want to speak to that. Well, I mean, I think what I was trying to get at with citing Edelman was this sense of, if we just like pick the narratological impulse, pick the idea of a story as having a beginning, middle, and an end, or just the idea of a narrative arc, if we just pick it out like a fish skeleton, you know, just like whoop, and then that's really liberating. And I suppose, you know, I jokingly reference the Italian job, but, you know, rather than blowing the doors off, maybe you're like opening the windows, and it's, as you say, like yeah. a soft porosity to the whole thing. Because there is you can see for yourselves that Gail is a transfixingly soft-spoken person, which is just something I find really appealing in anyone in whom I encounter it. But your poetry has that same quality. You know, it's really, it has this quality of quietness, which is so compelling and is so compassionate as well. Thank you all so much. A round of applause, please, for Gail.
Stephanie.